Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the death today of former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher and analyse her influence in championing an ideology based on individual liberty and market-based reforms that has come to dominate Anglo-American policy debates today. Historian Daniel Stedman Jones, the author of Masters of the Universe, Hayek, Friedman, and the Birth of Neoliberal Politics, joins us. Then we'll examine the case of the American jihadist who fought with the Syrian rebels, Eric Haroun, who today appeared in federal court charged with conspiracy to use a weapon of mass destruction outside the United States. Robert Young Pelton, the publisher of Dangerous Magazine, who interviewed Haroun before his arrest by the FBI, joins us to discuss the strange story of a hard-drinking, womanizing American army vet accused of consorting with Islamic fundamentalist Al-Qaeda terrorists. Pelton has an article at Foreign Policy, A Weapon of Minor Destruction, How Eric Haroun, the American Jihadist in Syria, Was Duped by the FBI into Incriminating Himself. Then finally, we'll speak with Amitai Etzioni, the director of the Institute for Communitarian Policy Studies at George Washington University, about his article at Salon.com, How Conservatives Still Run America Despite Losing Elections. We will look into the roots of how the will of the majority is thwarted by determined and well-funded minorities, and explore why the majority Democrats allow themselves to be bullied by the minority Republicans into compromising or caving. Joining us now is Daniel Stedman Jones, author of the new book Masters of the Universe, Hayek, Friedman, and the Birth of Neoliberal Politics. He is a barrister in London and has worked as a policy advisor for the New Opportunities Fund and as a researcher for Demos. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Stedman Jones.
Good evening.
And obviously, the death of Margaret Thatcher, who came into power in 1979 and left in 1990, has been tied into the Reagan era, in as much as both Reagan and Thatcher were a sort of a team, if you will, in many ways. But I take it in England there's a mixed message. The miners up in Yorkshire aren't shedding too many tears. And who are shedding tears for her in terms of the other side of the those who support her?
That's absolutely right, Ian. I think in England the legacy of Margaret Thatcher and her policies is very mixed. In America, I think you probably best remember Margaret Thatcher as the fellow struggler with Reagan in the Cold War against Soviet communism and as Ronald Reagan's staunchest ally. In England, we have a slightly different perspective, but I don't think it's just a perspective that English people should have. I think it's also a perspective that Americans and the wider world should also bear in mind when thinking about Thatcher, and that is the legacy of her neoliberal politics.
Well, in many ways, wasn't she ahead of Reagan in that sense? I mean, I know the miners' strike was in 84 to 85, and when Reagan, when he came in on his first day, he sacked the air traffic control union members and destroyed that union. So to that extent, they seem to have quite a bit in common, but she only preceded him by a year. But do you think that who influenced who, in other words?
That's absolutely right. She came into power 18 months before Reagan, and in that sense, she was definitely a trailblazer, and the Reagan administration certainly looked to her as a fellow traveler after they came to power. But you mentioned the air traffic controllers. That's a very interesting point. I conducted various interviews with former colleagues of Margaret Thatcher for the book, and they all mentioned the air traffic controllers strike in 1981 as a key moment that they drew strength from in their own battles with the miners when they were trying to face down the trade unions in Britain. And it also raises, actually, the miners' strike raises a very oft-missed element in Margaret Thatcher's political personality, which was that she was, as well as being ideologically strident, very pragmatic. So she, in fact, waited for the right moment to have the confrontation with the miners in 1984. She didn't pick the first possible chance to have a fight, as it were. Instead, she stockpiled coal, and she waited until until she felt that the government could win the strike against the miners. And in all of that, as I say, she very much drew strength from Ronald Reagan's own struggles with the air traffic controllers and drew inspiration from that.
Well, of course, the difference was that the air traffic controllers was a very small union, and it didn't really divide America in the way. And frankly, in America, the unions are so weak. They've been getting weaker by the decades. Now they're down to about 6 to 7% of the private workforce is unionized. But the struggle with the miners, it went beyond just it really divided the whole country, didn't it?
You're absolutely right, Ian. I mean, obviously, in America, that the unions were really seriously, fundamentally weakened, arguably in the late 40s, obviously. Whereas in Britain, the unions had really come to dominate the political scene in the 1970s. And whatever one's political views, certainly there had been a whole series of strikes, first in the Conservative government of Edward Heath in the early 70s, but then most famously just before Margaret Thatcher won the election in what was called the Winter of Discontent in 1978-79. And that really did mark a shift, I think, in British public opinion, because it was the unions had been up to that point relatively popular, and as you mentioned, in Britain the population of unionised workers was much higher. A significant majority of workers were unionised. But in the Winter of Discontent, there were a whole series of strikes across all different sectors, which swept the Labour government out of power, really. And so, again, it's just worth noting that Margaret Thatcher didn't immediately strike, as it were, against the unions in 1979, 1980 or 1981. She waited until what she saw was the right moment, when she could actually defeat the miners. And you're also right to point to the fact that this did divide the country very, very violently. And she actually referred to the miners as the enemy within. Which, of course, was very inflammatory language to use about a class of British subjects. So it was a long, bitter, and violent struggle, which, of course, in the end, she managed to win.
Again, I'm speaking with Daniel Stedman-Jones, author of the new book Master of the Universe, Hayek, Friedman, and the Birth of Neoliberal Politics. He is a barrister in London and has worked as a policy advisor for the New Opportunities Fund and as a researcher for Demos. And we're talking about the death today of Margaret Thatcher and her legacy. And I take it that her legacy really is what's happening today, is it not? You have a Conservative government practicing her policies of austerity, belt tightening, no free lunch, and it's a mess.
Well, I think that's right. Certainly, both political parties in Britain still define themselves really in relation to many of the debates really that Margaret Thatcher had in the 1980s, and I think that at the moment the austerity policies being pursued by the Cameron government really do have a parallel in the early 1980s policies pursued by Thatcher when she embarked on a monetarist economic policy when she first entered power, and in fact within a few months Britain was mired in recession much as it is today. So it's certainly the case that there are parallels in the current government's policy with what went on in the early 1980s. And, of course, one of her most important legacies, depending on your political views, this is a good or a bad thing, but she transformed British politics to the extent that the Labour Party would never be the same. I mean, in America, I think you would refer to the post-war period as the sort of New Deal order. Well, we had an equivalent in Britain, and it's certainly true that Margaret Thatcher and her policies brought that post-war consensus, as we call it in Britain, to an end, and actually instituted a new radical form of market fundamentalism to its critics, which has been in place ever since.
Well, didn't she say, Margaret Thatcher, that Tony Blair, New Labour were her legacy?
Absolutely, absolutely, she did. And, of course, you know, more liberal in the American sense or progressive critics of Tony Blair certainly have described Tony Blair as a Tory in disguise or a watered-down version of Margaret Thatcher. And it's also true that he didn't, a bit like Bill Clinton, again, in the American context, he didn't challenge fundamental elements of the economic policies that were instituted under both Thatcher in Britain and Reagan in the United States, but rather accommodated the Labour Party to them. So, for example, the emphasis was on developing the financial sector in Britain. The City of London is obviously one of our largest and most successful exports, and the Labour Party in the 2000s under Blair certainly relied heavily on that financial sector for tax revenue, ultimately to its cost once the financial crisis hit in 2007 and 2008.
Well, I guess there are parallels again with Bill Clinton in terms of the financialization of the economy and the growth of the power of Wall Street and the ruin that they brought. After all, Ronald Reagan appointed Alan Greenspan as the chairman of the Fed, and then he suddenly flooded this cheap money, and instead of the American middle class and working Americans getting wages commensurate with their standard of living, they were encouraged to get into credit as opposed to because wages have basically been flat since the late 70s. And then Greenspan, of course, stayed on and became Clinton's guru, and he basically engineered the great Clinton boom, which, you know, they got rid of Glass-Steagall, et cetera, and Wall Street got everything they wanted. And then, you know, by the end of the Bush administration, the whole thing blew up. So am I correct in suggesting that the financialization of the economies in both cases, there's a mirror?
I think you are absolutely right to suggest that. And I think it's very useful to think of the Greenspan era. Actually, I mean, it was the high point of a faith in free markets, which absolutely was entrenched first during the 1980s under Thatcher and Reagan, and that faith in the automatic correcting mechanism, if you like, of the market was obviously the fatal flaw that Greenspan was eventually forced to admit after 2008. And certainly in Britain, the economic story was even more obviously wrong, in the sense that to the extent that there was a monetarist argument, it was the argument that inflation would be reduced. Now, arguably, Greenspan did reduce inflation over a long period, and Paul Volcker had done before him. In Britain, in fact, during the 1980s, when Thatcher was in power, you have two big recessions, one in the early 80s and one at the end of her period in office, the end of the 80s and into the early 90s, where, in fact, you still have very, very, very high inflation. So even on their own terms, on monetarist terms, if you like, Thatcher's economic policies did not work. And of course, she did decimate the productive sectors of the economy without thinking about what might be put in place to replace those sectors. And so, you know, that has had a lasting legacy in Britain, because we have whole communities that lost, to go back to your original point about the miners' strike, which lost their ability to survive, really, by virtue of a lack of governmental investment and support.
So, in other words, England didn't have the Clinton boom years, which, of course, were the beginning of the bubble being inflated, which later burst in 2008 under George W. Bush. So you didn't even have that interregnum, right?
Well, it's slightly... No, I mean, certainly there was no boom under Thatcher. There was a brief period of growth in the middle of the 1980s, which then obviously collapsed into another recession at the end of the 80s. Mm. But you did have a boom, unlike in America, actually, in the 2000s, under Blair and Brown, and that really is the parallel
with the Clinton years,
and also in the British context as well as America, you get exactly the same financial deregulation under Blair and Gordon Brown, who succeeded Blair, which was followed by Clinton and subsequently under the Bush. The George W. Bush administration too. So in both Britain and America in the 1990s and 2000s, you get a continuation really of the financial deregulation, which began during the 1980s under both Thatcher and Reagan. And clearly those deregulation policies were one of the biggest causes of the crisis in 2008.
And Daniel Stedman-Jones, again, author of the new book, Masters of the Universe, Hayek, Friedman, and the Birth of Neoliberal Politics. Paul Kenny, the General Secretary of the GMB Union in the UK, speaking of Margaret Thatcher today, said her legacy involves the destruction of communities, the elevation of personal greed over social values, and legitimizing the exploitation of the weak by the strong. She did say, infamously, that there's no such thing as society. What was the context for that comment, and what did she mean?
That's an interesting point that you raised there, because Thatcher was, of course, similar to Reagan, was very, very influenced by her upbringing, and she had a sort of somewhat contradictory vision of a mixture of traditional conservatism, really, that was born of her upbringing as a grocer's daughter in the small town in Lincolnshire of Grantham, and those values really were very similar to kind of Victorian values of individual initiative and personal responsibility on the one hand, and the family and individuals being the most important units for the moral and the potential successful economic fiber of the nation, if you like, on the one hand. But then on the other hand, she had, of course, these very radical policies in terms of free market ideas, which were destructive of many of those older values that she held very close to her heart. And so when she was speaking about there not being any such thing as society, rather there were individuals and families, I think she was referring back to that upbringing as a small shopkeeper's daughter in a small town in the middle of England.
Well, it's sort of interesting that her predecessor was also the grocer's son, was he not, Edward Heath? But he proved to have a little more compassion. At least I seem to recall in his later years, he wasn't quite as rigid as she was.
You're absolutely right. Again, Ted Heath was a much more centrist figure. He was a supporter of the unions, and I mean, partly a product of the time, I suppose, too. But certainly, Edward Heath believed that government was a good thing, and government could do good things. He wanted it to be properly limited, but he was also someone who saw its use and utility. And in that sense, he was probably quite similar to Nixon. And again, this was something that that certainly Thatcher was to oppose very strongly. But she came to it partly by accident, because in 1975, when she first replaced Heath, she was not a fully formed radical. What she was someone who followed her instincts and followed her instinct, as I've said, in terms of these traditional conservative beliefs. But they became allies to this radical free market ideas and the neoliberal ideas, which came from places like the Chicago School and Milton Friedman, who was articulating his ideas in the United States. So it's quite an interesting mixture and quite an interesting development.
And it's quite ironic in the end that it was her own party that did her in.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, you know, in the end, she pushed this poll tax, which was a flat property tax for everyone in the United Kingdom, and that proved so unpopular that it led to riots. And this really did make even the Conservatives in her own party start to take notice that maybe she was becoming more of a liability than she had been before.
Well, Daniel Stedman-Jones, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to be on the show.
Again, I've been speaking with Daniel Stedman-Jones, who's author of the new book, Masters of the Universe, Hayek, Friedman, and the Birth of Neoliberal Politics. He is a barrister in London and has worked as a policy advisor for the New Opportunities Fund and as a researcher for Demos. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about how the American jihadi got framed certainly done in by the FBI.
Cottage small beside a field of grain.